What up, watchers? This is Matt from License to Watch, and this is the first of hopefully many special bonus episodes where we'll be interviewing some very special guests. To kick off our brand new Star Trek franchise series, I was lucky enough to get visual effects legend Michael Fink to join us for an interview about his work on Star Trek the Motion Picture. For the movie, he was credited in a long list of talented and soon-to-be-famous individuals under effects, props, and miniatures. Later in his career, he went on to be the visual effects supervisor on such films as War Games, Buckaroo Banzai, Batman Returns, Braveheart, Mars Attacks, X-Men 1 and 2, Constantine, The Golden Compass, Tropic Thunder, Avatar, and Life of Pi, among others. Michael Fink is now a professor in the Division of Film and Television Production at USC's School of Cinematic Arts, where he is a holder of the Georges Méliès Endowed Chair in Visual Effects. I'd like to give a huge special thanks to Michael Fink for allowing us to interview him for this show. And without further ado, here's the interview.
Why in the world was this movie made?
First of all, thank you for being a part of this show. It's called License to Watch, and we talk about movie franchises. And so this is our first episode where we're talking about Star Trek. And, of course, the first one up is Star Trek the Motion Picture. So in watching the movie the other night, I saw your name in the credits, and I said, this can't be the Mike Fink that I know. And I looked it up, and there you were. It was you.
Yeah,
so I guess... you know, a lot of us, like, this is only the second time I had ever seen this movie. The first time I saw it was a couple years ago, and I didn't remember. I remember liking it, but I do remember that it was really long and kind of drawn out.
Yeah. It's certainly not Robert Wise's greatest work.
So I guess first thing is, like, where were you in your career at this point? And I guess maybe talk a bit about how you came to be a part of this project.
Well, in the first couple of years of my career, it was 1979, as I remember. I think it was released in December of 79.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
We literally finished the film, the visual effects for the film, and the film was screenable at film a few days before the release of the movie in the theater. I mean, it was an incredible effort. And there was just enough time to get the prints out to all the theater to get it released. So it was a huge rush to get everything done. It was a big movie. I was a pretty low-level player because I was new. I started in the business at the end of 1977. So this was 79, and I'd been in business not even 2 years. But I had had the good luck of working on a couple of films where some people noticed that I knew how to do some things, and I got some... I got a reputation, actually, relatively quickly for being able to handle technical stuff and artistic stuff and things like, you know, it's sort of a mixed bag of skills. And that's really valuable in the film industry. So, you know, the more you can bring to the table, the better.
Yeah.
I was working on some reshoots for Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters. In the facility that was run by Douglas Trumbull in the marina. And Richard Jurasich, who was Doug's main right-hand person, cinematographer, a wonderful guy, part of a talented brother duo. His brother was a matte painter. Richard walked into the stage where I was helping set up this forced perspective miniature that we were going to shoot the Close Encounters special edition. And he he said, when are you going to be done with Close Encounters? Because we want you on Star Trek. And that was the first time I'd heard that Doug was even involved with Star Trek. Because prior to that time, the effects for that were at another place with other people. And apparently that all went south, and they turned the movie over to Doug. And so Richard came in and said, we'd really like you on Star Trek. And I said, great, I'll try to find out. And I had a couple more weeks on Close Encounters, and I went to work on Star Trek. And I was part of what Doug called, what we called the Gizmo Crew. And the Gizmo Crew was me, Mark Stetson, Bob Spurlock. We were on the effects, miniature, electronics kind of side of things. And then there were, and camp somewhat, my, at least in my role, some camera stuff. And then Hoyt Yateman won an Academy Award on The Abyss. Scott Squires, who's a very highly regarded effects supervisor and coder and a multi-talented guy, who was about like 19 or 20 or something at the time.
Wow.
And Scott, Scott and Hoyt were about the same age. And so Scott was there. And then there is an effects advisor who was for many years at ILM after this, but he went up there not too long after Star Trek, Scott Farrar. And Scott and I worked for months making miniature lightning on a small stage and shooting it at high speed with a Mitchell camera. And we did literally day after day of, I think it was about 2 or 3 months of photographing sparks, basically. All kinds of techniques. I learned how to blow glass so I could make special discharge chambers, so that we could make the sparks do what we needed them to do. They're not all that bright, but they, what Doug was hoping to get was lightning, literally capture lightning in a bottle, and he wanted lightning elements that could be composited into shots that didn't require the painstaking cell flopping and animation techniques that had been used for lightning up to that point. And he thought we could probably get there with this. The problem was getting sparks that were bright enough to shoot at high speed and stayed in focus, because we were at high speed and therefore we had not a great deal of depth of field. And because it wasn't very bright, and we had to open up to see the sparks. So Scott and I worked on that for months. We basically worked, most of the crew worked 18 to 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, from April of 79 or thereabouts. I think that's about when I went to work on that show, to, might have been a little earlier, but I don't think so, to December, when the film was finished and delivered to the studio to distribute.
Wow.
And so we would be on the stage shooting motion control shots of the Enterprise and the shuttle and that dry dock space. We had a name for it. I can't remember what it was called. And all of that been built before Doug got involved, before I got involved, all that kind of stuff. And much of it, although it was quite beautiful, was not ready for the camera. And the Enterprise was a real thorny problem. And the part of it was that the Enterprise was using, in order to have all those little lit up windows and things that are on the Enterprise,
mm-hmm.
and have them scale, what they did is they filled the inside of the Enterprise model with neon. That's a general term. It's not really neon. In this case, it was argon or krypton or something. Something that would light up kind of blue-white.
Right.
And neon's red, so as a gas when it excites. So you don't want to use neon unless you want red. So anyway, but same technique, same everything. But there were phosphors involved in the tubes and all. And these all had to be specially made by a fellow in Venice named Larry Albright, who is a brilliant, really artist slash scientist theorist person who could do just about anything with high voltage electric. And I got to know Larry really well on the show. We built a Tesla coil so I could make sparks. But in any event, on the stage, in between making sparks and all the other things, I was quite often on the stage working with Hoyt and some of the other people. The director of photography for all the miniature work was, as I remember, was a fellow named Dave Stewart, passed away some years ago, who was absolutely gifted, beautiful, brilliant cinematographer for miniatures and visual effects. And we would shoot these interminably long visual effects. So, for instance, when the Enterprise had to go into warp drive, and Doug and Robert Wise wanted to see the Enterprise streak away in the famous streak. Mm-hmm. We had to find a way. This is the very early days of motion control. So there was motion control, but it was not particularly sophisticated. And figuring out which, trying to control all the cameras, in other words, what the camera is doing, what the miniature was doing, because everything was motorized and connected to a digital system. I hesitate to call it a computer, but it was. But it was more like digitally controlling all those motors. And programming them was a painstaking step-by-step hand process. So the first streak shot we did, or the Enterprise going into warp drive, which was successful the very first time we did it. It was me and Hoyt and a couple of other people. I sometimes was loading magazines. Remember, I wasn't even 2 years. Sometimes I was loading magazines. And it was funny because Hoyt was maybe 20 at the time, and I was 35 or 37 or something. So it was weird, but he was brilliant and terrific. And so we worked together to figure out how to shoot the streak shots.
So I have a question. This might be a dumb, like the Star Trek people might crucify me for this, but the streaking, when the ship would go into warp drive, how did they do it on the TV show? Was this the first time it had ever been done this way, or did they kind of have a similar effect on the show, or do you not know?
It wasn't an unknown technology, but there were lots of technical things that came up in our photography which made it more cool. And one of those was that all of the effects for the movie were shot in 65 millimeter, which is 70 millimeter. Because everybody, the public knows it is 70 millimeter. The extra 5 millimeters is for soundtrack,
right?
But recording sound, so it was 65 millimeter. And with a format at large, this was 5 per 65, so it was about a 2-to-1 aspect ratio, and the depth of field is quite limited when you have that large an image plane. So that meant that you had to shoot at impossibly deep stops with a great deal of light, and you had to take a long time to shoot each frame because you were shooting at very small aperture. We had a special snorkel lens that Doug had built for some of the shots to get the lens closer to the Enterprise, to kind of scrape by the surface of the Enterprise, dry dock or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And because the camera is large and you can only get it so close to a miniature, and of course, in scale, the camera was about, to the miniature, was about maybe a sixth the length of the miniature. which made the camera the size of a pretty large spaceship. And that meant the cameras, if it were used like a real, like a normal camera, would be too far away from the miniature, would not scale.
Right.
The one thing that gives miniatures a problem is the problem shooting miniatures is you have to maintain depth of field, because if you were shooting the Enterprise out in space from 100 yards away, or which was what we were doing in terms of scale, it all has to be sharp. You have to be sharp from front to again. And if you're not, it does not look real.
Right.
So the exposures were really long. And then, I'm not going to go into the weeds here, but you know, if the exposure's too long, there's a thing in on motion picture film called reciprocity failure. And the colors start to respond differently to the light hitting the emulsion. And suddenly the colors get all whacked out of shape. And you have to figure out by doing tests what you need to do to the exposure to get or filtration or whatever, or lights, to get the color to look normal. So our first streak shot was the beauty pass. You had multiple paths. So you had a beauty pass where the Enterprise was all lit up and the dry dock was all lit up. It all looked really beautiful. And this was after about a couple of months, maybe, or a month of me and Bob Spurlock and Mark Stetson and a few other people rebuilding all of the electrical innards of the dry dock and the Enterprise, because the neon that was inside, which is high voltage, which means it's easy for it to spark an arc, was installed badly, not with respecting the fact that it was high voltage. And so there were actually the little tiny arcs and bad connections inside the Enterprise. So every time an arc goes like that, it actually produces radio waves. Computers were not particularly resistant to radio waves. So one of the first times we plugged in the motion control system and started to do a test with the Enterprise, it broadcast to the computer driving the camera and sent the camera flying down the track toward the Enterprise. And we hit, there was a big red button, panic button, that stopped everything. And we hit the panic button just in time before the camera rammed into the Enterprise and ruined us for quite a while.
Wow.
But also the Enterprise needed to be repainted. It was not well painted. And a brilliant miniature painter and scenic artist named Ron Gress was on board to repaint the entire Enterprise and the dry dock and all that and give it some sense of scale. With lots of detail, all added by paint, just like a texture map today in CG.
Mm-hmm.
So the first beauty path took 25 hours for a 96 frame shot.
Wow.
And we had to be there for all 25 hours. Jeez. And then we would change over at 96 frames. I mean, it's nothing, 4 seconds. And then we had to change over to do a matte pass because Doug used a technique called front light, back light, which I won't get into here because it's too much time. we had to do matte passes. We had to do bright light passes because the aperture at which we shot the Enterprise was not going to work if we had all the light on at the same time. Some of those lights would be blown out and some lights would be unreadable. So we had to make separate passes for all the lights at an exposure that recorded them properly. So that was another 15 hours, matte passes and light passes and things like that. About 40 hours total to get 96 frames of film. And sometimes we would do these shots. A typical motion control shot on the Enterprise would take a non-streak shot would take about 12 hours. And in answer to your question, streaks had been done before, but these had to be streaks like nobody'd ever seen before. First of all, there was a real design to them. And because we're shooting in 70 millimeter, 65 millimeter, we had to maintain depth of field through the whole 96 frames. We had a bunch of things that, and then account for reciprocity failure. So technically, they were quite challenging. Star Trek in the movie was really basically, in the TV show, it was basically the same technique. What you do is you open the shutter, and you either move the model or you move the camera so that one of them is moving relative to the other. But let's say you move the model a certain distance, then you close the shutter, you back up the camera, and you go shoot frame two, but a little bit longer, so it goes a little farther away. And then you go to frame three, and you do the same thing. So you shoot the pass with the shutter open, so it streaks on the film. You cap the shutter, you back up the camera, you open the shutter, and you shoot the next frame. So you have to remember that the frame has to advance, that you need a start and end mark that are different for every single frame. And the motion control system we used was really in the days of rudimentary level of program. And we could not control all those things at once. Hoyt was using what then would be called a pocket calculator to try to figure out when the camera should start and stop, because the computer couldn't handle that and do the other things, as I remember. So a long time ago. So we would shoot these long things. So every pass would take forever, wow. You know. So that's how we did the street shots. And that was one of the things that I really loved doing, actually, even though it took forever. And I only lived three blocks away. So I was one of the lucky ones. If I was working those hours, I could run home, take a shower, take a nap, come back to work, and do some more.
Oh, that's nice.
But we would have all these motion control shots, and then we would go to dailies the next morning. Remember, it wasn't digital, so we could not see what we were doing until it came back from the lab.
Right.
So we would run film to the lab in a big rush. There was a junior executive at Paramount who was put in charge of making sure we got done. And that junior executive at Paramount would wait for us to finish shooting until we got very, very close to the lab cutoff, where they wouldn't be able to promise us film in the morning.
Right.
And he would throw it in his Porsche and drive from the marina to East Hollywood to Deluxe, which was Paramount's lab at the time. Mm-hmm. And have the film process. That junior executive was Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Oh, wow.
And he would sit on a stepladder and watch us and wait. It was amazing. We actually loved him. He was totally committed to getting this movie done, just as we were, and it was really nice to see.
So maybe you could speak a little bit about, because there are a lot of effects in this movie, some better than others. Do you maybe have one that you are most proud of, or one that you are least proud of? Like, what do you think that you worked on, which came out the best, or which is the most successful effect shot, and then which is your least favorite?
Well, my least favorite were all those sparks, and the reason was that Scott and I had to figure out how to get sparks that were made usable elements that could be composited into the shot. And that took a few months. But by the time we got a technique, and this was, I had to create new chambers, glass chambers that would contain the spark within a certain range so it stayed in focus the entire time, things like that. So there was a lot of development work and a lot of work on the Tesla coil to make it more powerful or to change it in some way. So it took a while. Basically, we finally got there at about the same time that we ran out of time to shoot anymore. Wow. That it was, we got to a place where we actually could do it, but we didn't have any more time to make the elements. And so Doug defaulted to what had been done for decades and decades, which was hand animating spark. a number of the sparks, and there's shots in the movie toward the end when the crew is approaching V'ger and they're walking across that sort of hexagonal landscape,
right?
You know, sort of like the place, the coast of North Ireland where the basalt pillars are.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's like sparks in the background, like that come.
Supposed to be sparks in the sky.
Right.
And notice there are very few. And the reason is that we just didn't have enough sparks by the time. I mean, we really didn't have time. We were doing a year and a half's work in less than 6 months. And it was pretty insane in terms of the amount of stuff we had to get done. And a lot of it involved inventing things. Doug and Scott Squires and I flew to Utah at one point, which was a heck of a lot of fun. There was a guy who lived in Wendover, Utah, whose name I've forgotten. He was known as the Wizard of Wendover, and he had the world's largest Tesla coil. And he could make sparks that were about 2 or 3 inches in diameter and 40 or 50 feet long. So it was real lightning.
Wow.
And he worked in the hangar that had been the hangar for the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, in World War II. And he rented it for $1 a year from the military. And in exchange, he would do lightning tests on military planes to see if they could survive direct lightning strikes and stuff with this Tesla coil.
Wow.
Went there thinking, well, this is a way out of the dilemma of having enough exposure and getting scale and all this kind of stuff. And it was absolutely not controllable, just like lightning isn't. It was too powerful and too much. And we had a wonderful time for a day taking photographs and working with this guy, but there was no way we were going to really make film out of it. It wasn't safe either. So we went back home. But, you know, when we would do these big motion control shots, we'd go to dailies the next day and we'd see the shot and the ship would be flying along or the camera would be moving toward it. And the shot would be, let's say, 72 frames long and maybe took us 12 hours to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And camera would be moving along, and right in the middle of the shot, the camera would have a little hiccup, like it ran over a bump on the track, and then it would continue going. Well, that meant we had to reshoot the whole thing. There was no way to fix that.
What would cause the bump? It would just happen. What would cause a camera to bump like that? Just like a random.
Just a mechanical fault. And it was, you know, it could have been a bad frame in the data going to the camera, driving the motors for the camera. It could have been, you know, I don't remember it. It didn't happen often, but it did happen often enough where we'd have a beautiful shot except for one flaw and we had to go back and reshoot. But what I suggested was that we Doug and Robert Wise should go on the stage and shoot close-ups of like Spock and Kirk and Scotty and everybody else going, what was that? So we could use the shot. We could just cut inside to the guys inside saying, I don't know, Cat didn't, you know,
yeah,
it must be a dilithium crystal. And so we, nobody bought that and they didn't even think it was funny. There was no humor at that point. And nobody was laughing, you know. But, you know, I was trying to keep it a little lighter.
Kind of like this movie. This movie has no humor in it.
It doesn't. You know, it's one of the big problems is there's no irony.
Right.
So anyway, that was it. So my favorite piece in the movie that I was involved in is that section where the crew is walking toward V'ger, and off on the horizon, you see beams of light coming out of V'ger into the atmosphere. And I made the device that created those beams of light. And
Hey, Mike, are you talking about the shot when they're making like their final descent into V'ger, or you're talking about when they're already landed and they're walking around?
No, they've already landed.
Oh, okay.
Under the ship, and they're walking across that hexagonal basalt.
Okay.
Set. It was a practical set piece, and then the set was extended with V'ger off in the distance, and you couldn't really see V'ger. You can just see atmosphere, and you see the light of V'ger.
Okay, I know what you're talking about now. Yeah.
And they're walking toward it. And that's what I remember. I wanted to watch the movie again before I talked to you, but I've had no time. I'm working like 16-hour days. I didn't know that the shot was coming up. And I think Scott Squires came to me and said, "Mike, we need a light effect for V'ger. We need something that's going to, you know, make little beams of light into the, we're going to smoke up the room, and we need this beams of light going off into the thing, and it has to look kind of random, and it has to do this." And I said, "Oh yeah, okay, I can do that." And about 2 hours later, I delivered to the stage this little motion control device, which was made out of a Coca-Cola can and a V8 juice can and a 500 watt halogen lamp, two motion control motors, some gearing so that one of the cans could rotate against the other can, and they could be controlled separately at different speeds. Hmm. So they could be random. And the light bulb went in the middle and didn't rotate, because then I would have had to build a contactor for the wires and all that stuff, and we didn't have time for that. So I built this little thing, and we put it on the stage, smoky stage. And basically, I had a whole bunch of holes poked in the smaller can and a whole bunch of holes poked in the larger can. And sometimes the holes would line up and sometimes they wouldn't. And sometimes they'd line up halfway, but then they'd fade quickly. And sometimes they'd line up perfectly and be very bright and then fade. And it was perfect. It just worked. So they were hovering around me. I'm like on a milling machine. I'm making parts. I have to make everything from scratch, all the parts, all the stuff, and then get it onto the stage. So got it on the stage. Scott smoked up the stage, shot V'ger's effect. And every time I've seen it in the movie, I get a little tickle. I love the way it looked. And I'm really sorry that I didn't have more sparks. And then I really didn't like a lot of the spark work that we did. We did use a number of sparks that I shot. And because I knew them, I didn't like them particularly. But a lot of the shots are like the whole introduction of the Enterprise when Kirk arrives to the newly refurbished Enterprise and in that little shuttle.
The half hour long sequence of him looking.
Yeah, just in turn. It goes on forever. But
it's like spaceship porn. That's what I watched it with my wife, and she was like, "This is like, it's glorifying the ship to a point that it's almost pornography."
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It would have been more if we had more time. those shots were incredibly difficult. And I have to tell you, Dave Stewart and Doug are just so brilliant, or were brilliant in the case of Dave. And Doug had these wonderful ideas. Like, we needed to light the Enterprise, but the lights have to be in scale to the Enterprise. You can't just roll a 10K on a stick, which is practically the size of the Enterprise miniature. It wasn't. Enterprise miniature was about 6 feet long, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, half the size of the Enterprise. And you can't, you know, if you imagine a real light lighting a real Enterprise, that 10K would be just this tiny little speck in the frame. So Doug worked out this system with dental mirrors. And he and Dave developed this thing. So we had an array of dental mirrors and then like a 5K pointing at the dental mirrors. And then the dental mirrors would light specific areas, be rotated around to bounce the light onto the Enterprise and make little circles of light to highlight the NC-1701 or whatever the Enterprise was.
Right.
Pardon me, anybody who's the loyalist sometimes. I'm old and over 40 years ago, but I forget things. And the mirrors were just a brilliant, because they allowed us to scale the light. And they're just beautiful. When you watch the shot, it's like, wow, how did they do that? And in one of the shots, if you watch real closely, you'll see a little pool of light from the dental mirror moving slowly across the surface of the Enterprise. And it's just wonderful. And it was a complete accident. What had happened is whoever on the crew had tightened down that dental mirror, didn't make it quite tight enough. The dental mirrors had a little flexible head with a little screw, you know, neural screw. You could turn and tighten it up.
Right.
So you could tighten it up and then leave it. So it was oriented, it was tightened up, it was left. And then over 12 hours, we shot this shot. And over 12 hours, this mirror slowly started to sag, and we didn't notice it while we were shooting because it was, you know, over 12 hours.
Right.
Just don't even know. But we went to dailies, and there's this, it's like somebody was panning a light across the surface of the Enterprise. It's one of my favorite things in the movie. You have to, movie didn't have a lot to hang on to. What's funny is that I had a friend at the time, still a friend, but I never see him. He's a writer, but he's a journalist, not a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
Although we did work on some scripts together, and he was dating Persis Kambada.
Oh, wow.
At the time. And so he would tell me stories, which I don't want to relate, about that, but it was all great. Stories were not unkind to anybody. I just, you know, don't remember them well enough to really recount them.
Right.
But it was fun getting the other side of it from her experience on the set, things like that.
Did she have a good experience or not so good?
I think she had a good experience, but I think all the actors felt kind of like we felt on the movie. It was a little flat.
Yeah.
The basis of the story, the premise, was not bad, but you know, it didn't take the Star Trek TV show model and turn it on its head at all. You know, nobody did anything that was really surprising for that character, and you can understand why the studio didn't want to mess with the franchise.
Yeah, they saved that for the next movie.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know what Robert Wise thought. I mean, I don't know how much influence the studio. He was quite a famous and powerful director at that time.
Yeah.
So I, you know, have no idea, you know, what he thought. We had, you know, we worked ridiculous hours, a lot of fun. Our projectionist, an amazing guy, lived in the marina on a boat. He had a 50-foot sailboat.
Mm-hmm.
And we would take a lunch break and go out to the boat, and we'd leave the marina for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and go sailing, and then turn around and come back in and go back to work. And it was, I remember Scott Farrar in his little skinny Speedos, you know, and we were all young and fit, you know, we're a good looking group of people. And I just remember standing out there on the prow of the boat, you know, and it was, you know, so funny because like an hour later, it's dark room with this trying to make sparks. And, but it was a relief, and Doug knew that it was important for us to get these breaks. So we would take them, it kept us all together, so we all left work, showed up work at the same time, and nobody got bent out of shape. And it was a tremendously gifted, talented group of people. I mean, just the best. And I learned so much and had so much fun. So there were lots of things. I worked with Scott a little bit. Mostly it was Scott developing how to shoot the wormhole.
How about V'ger itself, like all the different surfaces of V'ger that you see? Did you have
they're flying in and the big maw open.
Yeah, it looks like a I was calling it a what did I call it, like a breathing pinwheel, it looks like.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's pretty much what it was. There was a guy who was an artist, and he made these moving, he was a technologist too. I never met him, and I don't know him, but you know, Doug did. He would make physical things that would fold together. They were like moving animating Chinese puzzles,
right?
If you can imagine. They just were phenomenal and required unbelievable levels of precision. And I think Doug decided that would make a great gateway to get into V'ger.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to make real something this guy had developed conceptually but never built. And it had to work with motion control motors and be able to drive a camera through it. So it had to be a pretty good size.
Yeah.
And it had to have immense scale. So it was filled with fiber optics. You know, back then we didn't have little tiny LEDs. We certainly didn't have CG, not in any meaningful way. And so we had to lace miniatures with fiber optics. And so we'd have a little fiber, a little skinny fiber that would be in a bundle down by a lamphouse. And the lamp house would be illuminating the fibers. The fibers would thread up and into the miniature and reach the surface of the miniature where that very end of that fiber would light up. So we could make really bright light sources that were less than a millimeter in diameter.
Wow.
And so, but again, requiring another separate pass by the camera that had to be, every time you did these passes, they had to be absolutely the same as the pass before, because otherwise you couldn't composite the two. We had this moth thing that was shot over at John Dykstra's shop. Doug reached out to John because the task was so huge that at the Maxella facility in the marina, which that building still exists, by the way. Almost everything else is condos all the way around. That building where Star Trek was made, still there.
Wow.
And people can look at balconies down onto this building. It's really funny. but the interior of the V'ger, as I remember it, was shot at Apogee at John Dykstra's facility. John and his crew took on a whole bunch of different shots of the film, and I don't remember where the line was drawn, right, honestly.
So you were more you were part of the Trumbull crew, and you guys focused on a lot of the not so much on the innards of V'ger, is what you're saying.
That's the way I remember it. Yeah, but I do remember being on the set with V'ger, and it feels in my memory like it was at the Maxella facility. But honestly, I remember also I had to travel to the Valley a few times and help with shots that Dykstra was doing, because some effects were the same effects being used on their shots. And so some of us would travel back and forth. It wasn't just me, to, you know, help recreate what we did at Maxella out in the Valley on a street called Valjean. Near the Van Nuys Airport, Apogee was there for decades, And so they did a number of scare, but we didn't have enough stage space at Maxella to do all of the had to do. And Dykstra had a totally expert crew. These are the people that won an Academy Award for Star Wars. You know, they knew what they were doing. So,
this movie
was great collaborating with them, and it worked really well.
Yeah. So this movie was nominated for visual effects also, right?
I believe it was. Yeah. I didn't look it up. Don't remember, you know, to be honest, but yeah, I think it was. Yeah. And we had mistakes in Star Trek. We went down technological rabbit holes that, you know, we'd get halfway down the rabbit hole and go, nah, this is not working. But it would take 3 or 4 weeks to figure out that it was never going to work. And then we'd figure out what our core problem was, and then we'd have to stop and start all over again, and without avoiding that problem. And it happened quite frequently. There were moments. There was a fellow, and I blanked on his name now, who was sort of like, he was an engineer, but he really managed all the hardware, with the exception of the cameras, but all the motion control hardware, all the track, all the motors, all anything you needed, you went to him. And of course, at that point, it was whatever you need, we'll buy it. You just tell us what. And one day I walked in from having lunch, and his name is so close, I can't remember. And he held up a catalog and he said, "Hey, Mike, can you use one of these?" And I looked at it, and it was a digital motor controller, a step motor controller. And I said, "I could use those this afternoon." He said, "I'll order them right now." A couple hours later, they showed up. We put them to work on the stage, and they helped us control. There's a shot in the movie where there's essentially, and I don't remember where it is. Again, I have to watch the film again, where there was a sunrise. And the sunrise is actually 5K pointed right into the lens. The sun was just a stage lamp. But the stage lamp had to rise. So we had to give it a controller that would allow it to rise up. And I think it was revealed behind the Enterprise. I honestly can't remember the shot that well. But we were able to use those controllers to control the light and the dimmer, that because the lamp had to get brighter as it rose. And of course, we didn't have electronic dimmers back then. We had these big dimmer panels that were basically rheostats. I mean, they were coils of wire, and depending on where the contact hit the coil of wire, depended on how many volts went into the lamp to make it bright. So they were dimmers, but they were definitely electromechanical dimmers. And they had levers, and they were used generally by people on the lighting crew on a live action set to change the light by you could dim or bright light by moving the lever. These levers looked like the kind of thing you see on the bridge of a steamship, you know, that, you know, they're like long control arms.
Right.
And there'll be a number of them across this big instrument. And the thing would be the size of a pretty good sized desk, you know, and high, tall. So we attached a stepper motor to one of the dimmer and put a pulley on it and tied a rope from the pulley to the dimmer arm. And then my little digital controller that we got controlled the dim by pulling on the rope and pulling the dimmer handle down, so that the light got brighter. It's pretty, a real combination of pretty basic Industrial Revolution stuff and modern
ingenuity. Budget. Yeah.
It was so much fun because we were really inventing as we were going, trying to make art at the same time. So it was a wonderful experience, and I didn't mind working all those hours. I was young enough, and I was in good enough shape, so it didn't kill me.
Yeah, so I don't want to keep you forever, but my last question was going to be if this was overall a good experience or bad, but I feel like you answered it, and it sounds like despite all the overtime and months of work that you had to put in, that it seems like a pretty positive experience for you.
It was hugely positive. It wasn't just for me. I mean, it was that everybody in that building and the people in I got to know and gained great respect for John Dykstra, who I'd never met before, and for his crew, Grant McCune, the miniature guy who has passed away, unfortunately, but Grant was absolutely brilliant. And these people are still my friends.
That's great.
We have been together. It was like going, I never went to film school, and none of these guys ever went to film school either. You know, Hoyt Yateman had a scholarship to play oboe at UCLA. and he didn't go to film school. I didn't go to film school. Scott Farrar didn't go to film school. None of us. But that was our film school were jobs like this. And because you work 20 hours a day, 7 days a week together, you really learn how to collaborate. You really learn how to depend on each other. You figure it out. You get it right.
It's like boot camp.
Those Mark Stetson and I are still really close friends. And I dragged Mark into Blade Runner to help me on Blade Runner, take on a really insanely intense 4 or 5 day task with his crew, which worked out very successfully. But could not have done with Mark on Blade Runner what I did if I had experience on Star Trek. And most of the people that worked with Mark on Blade Runner also worked on Star Trek. So Blade Runner was a great experience for me because it was like a bringing back together that crew. At that point, I'd been in the business for 4 years, so I was an old pro.
Maybe we'll save the Blade Runner stories for when we cover the Blade Runner series, all two of them, the two movies.
Yeah. Having to visit it like this in a kind of surprise, if I'd watched the movie, I would remember all the funny stuff.
Yeah.
Because a lot of funny stuff. We did a lot of laughing. But anyway, that's about it. I have to run. I have to get on Zoom.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Mike. And hopefully we can have you back another time for another discussion.
Okay, Matt. I hope this was helpful.
All right. Stay safe out there.